Look, I want to help, but I haven't played basketball in a long time. My timing's all off.
Eh, we'll fix your timing. Look at our facilities. We've got hoops.
We got weights.
We've got balls. Whoa!
Sure do. This place is a mess.
Mess? You're worried about a little mess? There's nothing here a little spit shine wouldn't fix.
Welcome to It's Innate, a podcast for developmental psychologists by developmental psychologists and everyday folk with an interest in infant and child development. I am Dion Benton.
And I'm Elena Luchkinen.
Great. So today it's our distinct pleasure to be speaking with Dr. Ashley Thomas, who is a postdoctoral fellow with the Center for Research on Open and Equitable Scholarship at MIT. I am extremely excited about this episode in particular because Ashley and I couldn't be furthest from each other on the theoretical spectrum, but that'll make for a very exciting episode today. I can't comment on Ashley's relation theoretically to Lena, but at least for as far as I'm concerned, we couldn't be further from each other, but that'll make for an exciting conversation. So welcome to the podcast, Ashley.
Thank you so much. I'm super excited to be here. Looking forward to the whole conversation.
Great. So for today's episode, like we always do, we're going to begin with a hot topic. So today we're going to be talking about, during that portion, some of the more controversial papers we've read recently or even in the past, talk about what makes them controversial, whether or not we agree with some of the takes, some of the conclusions from the paper. Papers, among other things. But before I do that, I think it's only fair that we ask Dr. Thomas, Ashley, to introduce herself and to talk about how she got into developmental psychology. For those who don't know her, apparently she is coming from an architecture background. So I would be very curious to know what the mechanism is by which she goes from that to developmental psychology. And then lastly, we would like her to talk about how she got interested in the specific topics we'll be talking about today. So that'll be the first segment. In the second segment, we are going to be talking about her recent paper that was published in Science called Early Concepts of Intimacy, Young Humans Use Saliva Sharing to Infer Close Relationships. And we'll talk all about that paper. So yeah, how does that sound?
Sounds great.
Great. I sort of butchered all that, but that's the whole point of podcasts. That's what happens.
It sounded good to me.
Freestyling.
Like there you go. Sounds good. Sounds good to me as well. And Ashley, I'm very intrigued also by your professional transition, because I think you and I share that both. I also didn't study psych in my undergrad.
I went to college without really knowing what I want to study. So I changed my major a bunch of times. Pretty typical. I landed on architecture. I should also say, I didn't know research was a thing that people did, especially as undergrads. So I don't come from an academic family. I ended up choosing architecture because it was really out there. It was really theoretical at UC Berkeley. So we talked a lot about what's different types of spaces and the way we design buildings were it's hard to even explain. It was kind of wild. And then I graduated and it was 2008. So the double whammy of being in architecture, triple whammy, in architecture, coming from a school that didn't teach me how to do anything useful, and there being a huge financial crisis that stopped anyone from building anything, made it very difficult to find a job. And in fact, I got fired from my first architecture job because I didn't know how to draw a window in plan. And my boss took me out to lunch and quizzed me and then fired me on the spot.
Oh man, that's tough.
And when it was horrible.
Like a software?
Oh yeah, no. So when you draw plans for a building, it's bird's eye view. Yeah, and there's a specific way you're supposed to represent a window. It's like a language. And I didn't learn any of that.
Surely there's many ways to draw windows, right?
No, there's a standard way.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, cause it's the plans are like what you give to like a contractor.
Uh huh.
So there's gotta be like a language that contractors can use.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway. So looking back, so messed up. Like, can you imagine doing that to someone? Like, yeah. Here's a test. You're fired. Right.
Yeah. So, it gives me the impression that they were like fishing for a reason to let you go. And then that's like a justification. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That type of shit happens. A lot, I'm sure.
It could be. So anyways, I got fired. And then I was like, well, I guess I'm not cut out to be an architect, which also looking back is kind of wild. But that's, you know, the thoughts of a 22-year-old, 23-year-old. Yeah, and then I thought I wanted to be a therapist because I was teaching high school kids. And I thought it was just like really interesting how these different kids, a lot of the kids I taught had various like social issues. Or other life circumstances going on. And I thought that was really interesting. And I happened to live in the Bay Area at the time, which meant that I could just audit classes. So I ended up auditing a Cog Sci class, which was amazing. Like I was like,
out of curiosity, who taught it?
You know what? I'm ashamed to say I don't know. It was during the summer, so it was a postdoc.
Okay.
It would be really
I would be
nice.
Ashamed if it was like Allison Gopnik or something. You just couldn't remember the first thing.
No. This is someone who I never had contact with sort of after that. But I did end up working in Allison Gopnik's lab.
Great. Good.
But the only reason I ended up working in her lab is because I thought that what I wanted to study was meditation. I was really interested in Buddhism at the time, also from auditing a Buddhism class. And she is really interested in Buddhism. And so I emailed her. And she was like, yeah, sure. Like you can volunteer. So I was working in my teacher job and then volunteering on the weekends in her lab. And again, I was just like, whoa, there's a whole world of developmental psychology. Like this is even cooler than the Cog Sci class that I audited. And then I applied to like 4 grad schools because I didn't really know what I was doing and ended up getting into a place and went to grad school. Yeah.
That's great. What is that place?
Oh, yeah. I did my graduate.
Maybe that's the reason why you don't want to mention the name. I don't know.
No. I love you, UC Irvine. Okay. I loved my time there. I loved the students there. Anyways, UC Irvine's great. I did my graduate degree at UC Irvine with Barbara Sarnecka. And to answer your question about like how I got really interested in social relationships, that's also kind of a story because I didn't really know what I wanted to study. She did like all of her previous work was about number concepts, which is amazing work. It's a beautiful body of work. And I still think about it all the time. Mm-hmm. But when I got there, I was like, so do you have like a project for me to work on? And she was like, nope. you can kind of study whatever you want. So the paper that really got me going on this whole idea of social relationships is actually it's like a 3-page paper by Lottie Thompson and Susan Carey that was in a like navigating social world book. That's just like here's what some innate primitives could be for social relationships. Yep. There's this guy, Alan Fiske, who kind of proposed this. And then I was like, I read a bunch of Alan Fiske's work. And since then that's what I've been obsessed with. So.
That's a very interesting, circuitous, but nonetheless exciting route to how you go from architecture on the one hand to developmental psychology on the other.
I will say there is a fun fact about my thesis in architecture was called Poem Forest Light, which is like typical, what the heck does that have to do with buildings? But it did, I swear. But I actually there's citations to psychological research because I was really interested in sort of like what's the experience of going through a building and like being in different spaces and stuff like that. So it's not totally wild that I ended up where I am.
Absolutely not. No.
But it is pretty like on the surface, it's pretty random. And there is a bunch of randomness to it. So it's not like,
I mean, there's certainly a lot
of science. Would you say that architecture in some way, like maybe the knowledge of how things fit together or anything else, the knowledge of design, the knowledge of spaces somehow informs the way that you do science in a way that, you know, other developmental psychologists might not have that insight.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think one thing it's really helped me with is making stimuli, which is a boring answer. I'm really
except when it comes to making those damn windows.
Yeah. Well, drawing
just make windowless houses.
I could, yeah, maybe like my next experiment will be like do babies intuitively understand what windows and plan look like. No, the it helps with being crafty. But I also think like on a deeper level, the way like, you know, maybe the big space between me and Dion's viewpoint comes from this fact that I really think about representations in the mind as these like little diagrams, and like mm-hmm. whether that's good or bad is a really open question.
Which is interesting because I don't know if I disagree with that. I disagree about how they come about. There are representations. I'm a developmental cognitive scientist after all. I'm not a behaviorist. There's stuff in the mind that is representation.
Dion, I think you and I might not have such a big rift as you think we do.
Maybe we don't. Maybe I just want to play it up because that's how you make episodes exciting and relationships. I don't know.
We're going to end being like, actually, we agree on everything. Anyways, that's a good question, Lena. I think it probably definitely affects some things. And you know, the type of architecture that I was taught was very like postmodern. What is time? What is space? And like, mm-hmm. those are the types of things that cognitive scientists are really interested in. I mean, of course, we're not interested in the real answer. We're interested in what people think is time and space. But ultimately, I think that's kind of what these postmodern architects were kind of getting at, because they were really interested mm-hmm. in like people's experience. So,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You're designing for people. Right. So in some sense, you have to be sensitive to, right? I mean, people are supposed to be patronizing these places to some extent. So they have to at least be iterable.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually what made me the fact that that's not really true when it comes to architecture school is a big reason, at least my experience in architecture school. And I don't know if that's still true at Berkeley. I don't know if that, and it varied a lot by who we talked to. So like Jill Stoner was my thesis advisor. She was really into that idea of like, this is for people. And she, her like work is beautiful. But there was this sort of tendency there that it was just about the architect.
Right.
I wonder if there is some sort of clever, you know, way to leverage that, you know, the way that we study spatial cognition and the way that, you know, the perception of space influences the way one operates inside that space. I'm sure that there are some, you know, applied social psych studies on that, but I wonder if perhaps developmental work could also enrich our understanding of how architects should be designing spaces.
Oh, there's actually, so I don't know about whether or not developmental psychology can inform how architecture should be designing spaces, but there's definitely work in the field looking at, you know, the perception of different relationships. So Paul Quinn has done a lot of this work. Marianella Casasola at Cornell has done some of this work. Again, I don't know to what extent this would inform how architectures design buildings, but there's definitely work looking at aspects of architecture that are relevant, right? Or that could be relevant to architecture. Absolutely.
Right. I'm obviously not an expert in this particular world. I was just thinking that, you know, there are possibilities like the way that we view others within a space, depending on the constraints of that space. And, you know, matters like that might be rooted in some of the developmental processes that we just don't know of. So I don't know of the current work that is looking to that. I'm just saying that you have a unique perspective that might make you an extra competent developmental scientist.
This is kind of cool. Put two people in an Ames room. Right. And then ask whether or not infants think that the big person, the person that looks perceivably big, has godlike qualities. I don't know. There you go. That's how you link the two. Yeah, I don't know. That could be interesting for sure. And maybe there is some of that work going on.
Yeah. I mean, architects. So there, I know that there is a little people, because this comes up sometimes when people will tell me, but I can't remember any specifics. I know people are kind of interested in this somewhere, but I mean, architects certainly make these type of arguments. Like, Frank Lloyd Wright's really famous for making like uncomfortable furniture. So people mm-hmm. like would interact more with each other. I mean, right. In some sense, like the modern the modern era of architecture was all about trying to control people through spaces, and it kind of failed. So there was this idea that you could solve a bunch of social problems by creating spaces where people were equal, for example, to sort of like create these utopias where, you know, everyone had exactly the same house in these big structures. And the argument there was often that will make people feel like they're equal to each other. And so it'll solve all these social problems. But ultimately those projects failed. And you know, why they failed is an empirical question and an interesting one. Kind of looking back on it from my perspective now, like, it's like, of course they would fail. Like, you can't just put people in spaces and then like expect them to totally change and have no history suddenly.
Which is interesting, because how do you reconcile that with like certain memory techniques, like the memory palette? It's a technique based on space.
Yeah. Right?
In places. And that technique is supposed to be exceedingly effective.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it's tough. It's really tough to make people change social relations, right? I mean, that's kind of like a huge challenge in the world.
But it's innate.
Well, no. I don't no, I mean, a lot of times, like a good example is like Brasilia. Brasilia, I think, is still the capital of Brazil, but architects were like, this is going to be our like thing, right? Like, we're going to make this new capital of Brazil. It's going to make it so all these social problems go out the window. But what they did is they put it in the middle of a desert where nobody wanted to live. They made these like this city that's like, I've heard, is not pleasant to be in. And then they had a bunch of people build all of this stuff and didn't build any housing for them. So what happened is they're called favelas, I think, in Brazil. I don't know if this is still true, but they're like, right after these people built the city, it's like those people weren't in their plan for equality, which is insane, right? So there was just like rings of these favelas around Brasilia. And that's what I mean. It's like, why did it fail? Well, that's a clear case of them just not understanding the social world that they were trying to change, right? And sort of seeing these like quote unquote lower class people as invisible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of examples like that. Paris is another example. Mm-hmm. When they redid Paris. Anyway. Wow, I haven't talked stuff in a long time. This is fun.
Yeah, that's I mean, it's exciting. I mean, I always like talking about stuff that I don't do. So
yeah.
And this seems to be like way out there in terms of what I'm doing at this point, or what I've ever done, to be quite frank.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about, you know, whether or not any of us have read a controversial paper recently, and kind of what makes it controversial. I'm happy to start, but I'll sort of cede the floor to you two. Do you guys have any papers that you'd like to talk about? Is there anything that you've read that was particularly salacious lately? I have one, but we're going to talk about it in segment two.
That took me a second.
Yeah, I know.
Uh-huh. I was like,
just kidding.
So I wanted to maybe bring up this one debate that is not necessarily a paper, although I'm sure that people by now have written commentary. And I think that in some way it will provide a segue to our second segment, where we'll talk about Ashley's work. So I don't know if you guys followed, but on CogDev's society list, there has been a long discussion about whether we should be using puppets for developmental research. And I shared some of that sentiment. I ended up writing a review paper on children's reliability judgments. It's not published. It's a just a little manuscript. But it looked like to me that some of the reliability judgments that were found with human experimenters or human actors weren't replicated with puppets, and the other way around. So there were sort of broader and more bold claims that were made with puppets that weren't necessarily true when human experimenters were doing the acting instead of the puppets. And in the study that Ashley, you published in Science, which is a very elegant design, but it does have a puppet as the key character. And so I was curious, especially because this physical trait, having saliva, is something to be assumed about a puppet, especially if you're a baby. So I wonder,
should we bring up that particular question in the second segment, maybe?
Sure. I mean, we can come back to that, but I just wanted to, you know, make it relevant, right? Because just an abstract, you know, puppets aren't humans. My argument against using puppets would have been that you have to quarantine a lot of knowledge about reality, that puppets aren't alive, that puppets don't, you know, have feelings. So when you have to quarantine so many of your pieces of knowledge about reality, then making a leap and assuming something else about a puppet might be easier than dealing with actual humans and taking the constraints that come with humans as actual real ones. What do you think of that? And perhaps where do you stand in that debate?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm actually an author on a paper. I'm like the third author. So it's Jonathan Kaminsky, Kelsey Luca, me, Kylie Hamlin, and Mike Frank, where we really like think through this. And it was a really fun paper to write because it was one of those papers where we were like, you know, questioning all, a bunch of stuff that I just did because other people had done it. Like who, the people's work that I was building off of course, it's not like I didn't think about it, but a lot of times I was building off other work. And yeah, so let me make sure I understand your argument against using puppets. So you were saying I thought what you were going to say is that it would make it harder to infer things about puppets because you have to do all this mental work to like see it as an agent, basically. But then you said actually it would be easier. So could you just explain again why? I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you necessarily. And in fact, that's one reason to use puppets. But yeah, I guess what I was curious about is what from your viewpoint, why is it easier to make inferences about puppets instead of humans?
I think it's easier to make sweeping inferences about puppets. I think in particular, I was looking into papers that explored something called a halo effect or a pitchfork effect in children's reliability inferences about others. Mm-hmm. And I think research with puppets was finding that if a puppet is stronger, then children tend to make these sweeping generalizations that they're also smarter and kinder, you know, things like that. General valence judgment about every social trait. Whereas I don't think the same findings were true when the actors in the study were human. And so my thought there was then, but of course, it makes sense for you to make those judgments because you don't know much about puppets. Right. Puppets are not living things. They don't actually talk, think, feel. But for the sake of their exercise, you're saying, all right, fine, let's endow them with all these properties. But at the same time, I don't know, like puppets don't really have physical strength. What do I know? It's just easier to say, right, fine, this is a good puppet. And if I said that this puppet has social traits, I'll take this one piece of evidence and generalize it broadly. What else do I know about puppets? Nothing. But humans, I have a lot of data on. Humans tend to vary in how kind they are, even if they're equivalently strong, or how knowledgeable they are, even if they're equivalently kind. And so the data that I have on humans will be factored into my judgments, whereas I have very little data on the puppets. You just told me they're alive for the sake of this experiment, but that's all I'm going to assume. And for that reason, I thought that they're not quite interchangeable as actors in an experiment, especially when it comes to social judgments.
Yeah. So I agree with you. The argument that we make in that paper is that there's a trade-off between, like, you know, we're focusing on infant researcher. We're all infant researchers in that group. Of course, we've probably all done studies with kids too, but I think most of us on that paper would consider ourselves infant researchers. And the argument that we make in that paper is that there's a trade-off between I always get messed up what these words actually mean. Basically, like, we acknowledge that the ecological validity isn't great in these experiments, right?
It's the point.
But
I would argue, actually. Sorry.
Yeah, but the trade-off between sort of both, as you're talking about, like, all these biases that infants will bring in about specific people based on, you know, we don't know, right? Like, we don't know what their experiences are coming into the lab. So the idea with using puppets is that they don't have all this prior knowledge, and you're able to manipulate them easier, mm-hmm. and they're simpler. So there's some sense in which there's actually a study about causality where if you use, like, toys with wheels, mm-hmm. then it doesn't work. But if you just use these
Cohen, like, and Oaks, 1993.
Yep. Thank you, Dion.
Yep.
Dang, you have I'm already impressed by just your ability to recall
capabilities. Well, that's my
I'm
area.
I'm horrible at that. I'm always
defense,
like,
in my defense, that's my area.
So I know, but like, so. In my area, I'm like, oh, I know there's a paper. I'm always having this embarrassing thing where I'm like trying to recall, like,
oh, that's funny. Yeah.
I'm really bad at proper names in general.
Me too, actually, believe it or not. I forget most people's names. I have a good memory for papers, not for people's actual names. Like, when I meet someone, I'll forget my students' names. I'll be like, what was your name? I called you just yesterday. What was your name again?
Maybe I too can be like you one day. Yeah. Anyways.
But I'm sure Dion downloaded psych info into his head. That's what happened.
Google Scholar. Come on. I'm up to date.
wait, no, but we really want to be using a Sci-Hub.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Right. I'm yes.
What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, yeah. The argument we make in this paper is, like, you know, there's a bunch of evidence that infants, you know, see these various levels of being a puppet. So mine's probably the most, the puppets I use are probably the most sort of complicated, going from that all the way to just, like, shapes that don't even have faces, like in the Shebra studies. Mm-hmm. And that because there's this evidence, we can be relatively confident that, like, they see these things as agents. But that ultimately, like, there is this trade-off, and it's like, you know, at the end of the day, it's an empirical question. So I'm kind of open, like I said, like, I thought writing that paper was fun, because I appreciated kind of picking this apart a little bit. But yeah, I don't know. It's both, there's a bunch of empirical questions here, which is like, what do infants think about puppets exactly? Does it matter where they're from? Like, does it matter how many, like, or what their upbringing is like in terms of how much exposure they've gotten to puppets? Like, I don't know. There's a bunch of questions that I think are pretty interesting. But at the end of the day, writing that paper made me feel more confident in using them. Though I think there's always good reasons to do both. And when we talk about my paper, I can talk a little bit about why we ended up using puppets. Especially because you're right, puppets do not have saliva.
It's interesting. It sounds like actually there might well be much more overlap between your perspectives and my own, because I actually, based on what you just said, I don't think I read the paper that you wrote with Jonathan and Kylie. Who's the other person? I'm already forgetting.
It's Kelsey Luca and Mike Frank.
Okay, yeah, Mike Frank and Kelsey Luca. I don't think I read the paper. Well, based on your description, I don't disagree. And I actually, when I was reading through the thread, obviously, we all were exposed to it. I thought many of the arguments against the use of puppets were actually kind of overblown. And I think they kind of missed the point. The point of using the puppets is to allow us to increase our internal validity, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we're not so much concerned with what extent this is actually true. We're actually interested in to what extent are we manipulating the thing that we think we're manipulating. Secondly, studies that use these artificial stimuli and use puppets are often designed to look at mechanism. That's critical. Why? It's because if you don't use artificial stimuli, it's hard to know on what basis the babies are responding. Are they responding on the basis of the familiarity with the stimuli, or are they responding on the basis of the hypothesized mechanism? And so while, again, I do see real problems, there can be real problems with using puppets. I think that the arguments that were often made against the use of puppets in that thread were kind of overblown and, again, missing the point. And I say that as someone who's actually criticized, in fact, in the paper that is recently published, like, some of that work, right? But I recognize the importance of that work and what it can buy us as a field in understanding those processes and mechanisms, which we all care about as a developmentalist. So that's my perspective on this. Yeah.
I think Dion, to build on what you said, I think it depends on what question you're asking, because if you are interested in endowing someone with the status of an agent, then and at the same time not bring in any of the knowledge about, you know, society, human beings, and everything else, then puppets offer an advantage. If you're asking a question, on the other hand, how babies or children in particular make inferences about human beings, and so I think in the world where we study, for example, whom they choose to trust, and especially when we ask questions about epistemic trust, which is which stands for us trusting that person's knowledge and competence, stripping the knowledge about human beings doesn't necessarily strike me as quite the right way to go, or at least not the right way to go in every aspect. Whereas if we are asking, if let's take an agent, and we know that that person has intentions, thoughts, and acts on those intentions, and that's enough. We probably don't want to assume much more about that agent. Then puppets are excellent.
It's interesting. So I disagree, actually. I think when you study, when you're trying to ask a question about what infants know about humans, or how they go about reasoning about humans, you're often focusing on some abstract quality that ties to the humans. And so there's a sense in which using puppets allows you to get at that abstract quality without muddying up the actual playing field by bringing in or importing other perceptual features that are also tied to humans. And so I think there is a necessity to some extent to use artificial or puppets or whatever the case may be. Maybe puppets aren't the right thing, because puppets still have eyes and people have eyes, and maybe they're making inferences on the basis of that familiarity. But in any case, using these impoverished stimuli, I think, are very useful still in studying how babies make inferences about people, because you're often studying not the people per se, but some abstract quality or abstract thing that the person is engaging in, and whether manipulating that causes changes in behavior. So I would still argue that I think it's still useful to use, maybe not, again, not puppets maybe, but some impoverished stimuli, and then scale, then go up. Because I think there is something to the question of, okay, well, you show that this works in the lab, but like we know that the world is much more rich than that. So what happens when you scale up and you introduce even more variables? But I think in order for us to isolate those variables that we care about to begin with, we have to start with impoverished stimuli. Otherwise, there's too many confounding variables that it could be impossible to know what's driving the effect. That's actually why I use impoverished things, because I have tighter control and I know what's driving the effect. But people often say, well, how does this generalize? How does this sort of scale up? That's the next question. Does this scale up, right? Yeah, you show it works, but do they do this in the real world? That's a separate question. And it's an important question, no doubt.
Maybe it's worth contrasting then results. So when we do look into validity of using puppets in various experiments, perhaps, you know, just throwing it out there for many babies if they're interested, trying to always run another condition in which puppets are replaced with humans and seeing if that actually makes a substantive difference.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, I mean, I guess you can make the argument too that like it shouldn't matter, right? If you're assuming that the phenomenon that we're studying are robust, it shouldn't matter what the stimuli we use are, like what they look like, right? If the phenomena, like let's say we're focusing on social evaluation, it shouldn't matter if you instantiate a social evaluative interaction in the context of puppet interaction or in the context of people or on Zoom or in person. Like if these phenomena are robust, none of that should actually really matter. And so you might otherwise expect that if you scale up, you might see the same thing, or even, you know, maybe a more pronounced version of it, because now you have more, it's just richer. I don't know.
That's making an assumption though, that you, that as a participant in an experiment, you do interpret what is in front of you as a social interaction. So that's, you know, I think that there is some argument to be made. Like, yes, there is I can't cite a paper like you do, but definitely read a paper.
Art Collis, the one I want to talk about, wrote it just recently, 2021, the violation of expectation method. That's one of his arguments, actually. What you just said is one of his arguments.
That's not the paper I had in mind. There's Susan Johnson's work, but I don't remember which exact paper, basically saying showing that by about 18 months, I believe, maybe even before then, babies are willing to extend agent properties to things that interact in a certain way. even if they don't have morphological properties of agents that are typically humans for us. But yes, again, it's, you know, bits and pieces. I'm just saying that I think that discussion is worth having. And I'm happy that people are now looking closer into it, because there's so much in our field that hinges upon assumptions that we're making when we present certain stimuli to the participants.
I agree with you 100%. But just take as an example, Jenny Safran's work with TP. Right. So she, you know, as you all know, she has shown that 8-month-olds can track transitional probabilities in a very contrived artificial language. Right. And one of the questions that sort of that resulted from that work was, well, OK, that's great. You show that they have access to this mechanism. But do they actually use this mechanism in a world where language, where TPs are competing with other cues like prosody, right? These other language cues. Right, and she's actually subsequently done some work, and so there's a situation where I show you.
By TP, you mean transitional probabilities, right?
Sorry. For those who aren't in the know, I mean transitional probabilities, right? Which is basically knowing that some words or some syllables are more likely to follow others. So, like in pretty baby, T is more likely to follow pre, but it's unclear what's going to come after T, right? Any word, pretty house, pretty kid, pretty dog, right? Anything can come after. And so early on, this work has shown that, again, babies have this capacity to track transitional probabilities. But again, it was in this very contrived situation. And a very valid criticism of this work is, well, you show that they have access to this mechanism, but do they actually use this in the real world? What happens if you make the language that they're this continuous speech stream more rich, or you add in competing cues, right? And also, what do they even do with, like, once they've detected word boundaries, what do they do with the words, right? Do they, like, are they just sitting there? Like, do they associate them with other things, right? So these are questions that those very basic studies cannot possibly answer, but are critical, because we're ultimately trying to make claims about what's happening in the real world, right? So, but you, again, I think I would argue that you have to start from the most basic and then go up. Otherwise, you don't know.
I do have one just small thing that Rebecca Sachs, as Dion mentioned, is my advisor right now, that we were talking about, that it's weird that in our line of work, we just show every baby one, often, not everybody does this, but we often just show every baby one, like, version of, you know, in my case, a woman taking a bite of an orange, feeding a puppet, and taking another bite of an orange. So we were thinking about how, wouldn't it be interesting if, rather than just getting what we consider as like the perfect take, you know, it takes a long time to get those videos right, partly because I'm not a professional, but why not, you know, get 4 different teams of research assistants, give them a description of what you want, and then use all of those in an experiment. And at least on this much smaller scale, is our effects robust? And, you know, this is even a step lower than, I think, Dion, what you had in mind, but it does feel like, wouldn't that be better? Like, because there have been cases where there's artifacts in an infant study, and it turns out that can explain the results. And wouldn't that be awful?
On Twitter, actually, I saw someone make maybe a thread or something about exactly this.
And they said, really?
Like, yeah. So this is interesting. Yeah.
I didn't see that, but yeah. I can't remember. God, I'm so bad with names. He's a language person. I think he's at BC. Anyway, he brought this up to Rebecca, so I shouldn't give us credit for coming up with it. But and if only I can remember who it was. He's like a famous person. I should really know what his name is. Anyway.
Todd Yarkoni has made the same argument, actually. He wrote a piece on, like, mixed effects models and, like, how we really should be, in addition to treating subjects as random effects, we should also be treating stimuli as random effects. But the problem is, we can't do it because we often only use one kind of stimulus, right? So,
but
therefore, we don't know if...
Yeah.
But therefore, we don't know if the effects are being driven by the stimulus, because we're not varying that, right? So, exactly.
I mean, with any experiment that I've ever done with adults that are like the vignette style things, I always have like 5 or 6 different examples because of this reason. And so it's just a little wild. I've never been like, that's pretty problematic, because it's so obvious when you have a specific thing, you're like, oh, well, it could be driven by some specific thing in this exact example.
I agree with you. See, man, maybe there's some more overlap. Like, shit, we should be like testing on Zoom in person using multiple different kinds of stimuli. I agree. All this is, wow.
That, see, I love that our podcast is bringing you guys closer together, but Before, I think now might be a good time to take a break before we go into the second segment.
I really wanted Dion to talk about this Paulus paper because I know the paper. I like skimmed it, but I didn't read it, and I was curious what your take was.
Oh yeah, so are you happy? Are you? Maybe we can spend 10 minutes talking about it.
Sure, okay? Sure. Is this busy person Josh Hartshorn?
Yes. Thank you. Josh Hartshorn is the person who gave us that.
I actually met him to attribute credit.
I think I met with him. Maybe I didn't.
He's like an incredibly well-known person. I don't know why I can remember.
I think I gave a talk there at some point in like the maelstrom of talks I was giving last semester. Anyway, yeah. Okay, so yeah, so the paper that I think that's most controversial, the one that's come out most recently rather, or the most recently controversial paper, was one that was written by a guy named Marcus Paulus, who actually didn't know before I read the paper. But I like looked at his Google Scholar page, and he's done a lot of work on topics that I'm interested in. And actually some of his ideas are very much in line with my own. So I'm like kind of embarrassed that I haven't actually read his work and like I somehow missed it. But in any case, he wrote again this paper where he basically argues that developmental scientists, specifically those who study infants, should dispense with the use of the violation of expectation method, right? So this is one of those methods, one of the many methods that infant researchers use to study cognition in babies, right? So we have habituation, we have familiarization, we have violation of expectation method, we have paired preference, among many other kinds of methods. And he argues that specifically we should abandon the violation of expectation paradigm for a number of reasons. But before I sort of quickly outline some of those reasons, it's worth talking about what makes a violation of expectation paradigm exactly that, like what makes it a VOE paradigm, as it's sometimes called. So typically what happens in these studies is that the researchers will present the babies with some event over which some expectation could be formed, right? So I think an example might help. So let's imagine that I'm showing you a stage, and on the stage there's a cup or some kind of surface, and on top of the cup I have a ball, right? So the ball is sitting on top of the cup, and the cup itself is sitting on top of the surface, the table or the stage, right? So the idea is that during this phase, what the baby is doing is they're forming some expectation, that is, the thing is being supported, right? Some belief. And then what you do at TESS is you show them events that either violate some expectation that they would have formed during the initial phase or that is consistent with, right? So at TESS, I might show them an event where the cup is ostensibly suspended in the air, basically in the exact same position that it was during the original phase, except now it's not being supported by anything. So it looks like it's just in the air, right? So that would be like a violation of expectation event. And then another event would be something that would be consistent with your expectation if you understand gravity. So you might actually have the ball on the stage, right? And what these studies often show is that babies do in fact look longer at the impossible event, the event that would have violated their expectation, right? That's the basic method. And there's actually a logic that underlies the construction of the test event. So it turns out that the impossible events are always perceptually most familiar to the familiarization stimuli, but conceptually they're novel, they're impossible, right? Whereas
they're not always impossible, they're just inconsistent with
impossible, right? So they could be inconsistent and impossible, but the important point is they're perceptually familiar and inconsistent or impossible, whereas the event that's possible, right, or consistent with our expectation is perceptually novel, right? So you're sort of forcing them, you're giving them a forced choice essentially. Right. And again, what babies tend to do is they tend to look longer at the conceptually novel, impossible, or at the event that violates their expectation. Right. So that's how it typically works. And so he goes on to sort of spell out some reasons why we should abandon that approach. The first is sort of aligns with what we've talked about in this podcast, which is that the reason we should abandon this approach is because we're importing on the babies an expectation that adults have, but infants may not otherwise have, right? So in that example I gave you, I'm assuming that babies are attending to the physics and they understand that unsupported objects fall, but we don't actually know. Right? We don't have incontrovertible evidence that, in fact, babies have these expectations. And so the fact that babies look longer at the impossible event may not actually indicate what we think it indicates. Secondly, he argues that because these studies use the familiarization paradigm, And because the test event, the impossible event, is always most perceptually familiar, well, we don't know if they're looking at that event because it's impossible or because they haven't finished encoding a representation from familiarization, right? That, in fact, that's one of the reasons why most researchers use habituation. It's because you want to try to control for that possibility. That is, you give the baby the opportunity to form a representation of the thing that they're being shown, such that longer looking at one test event or the other cannot be due to a lack of familiarity, right? And so, you know, and this is actually, this is like an old argument that he like didn't make. This is an argument that Leslie Cohen has made. This is an argument that other people have made. Like, this is an old argument, but it's another one of his arguments he makes. And then he also argues that the test events in these studies often tend to be quite different from the familiarization events. And so even if they do look at one event or the other, how do, like, what, like, because many things change between fam and between fam and test, which of these things that are changing is driving the effect, right? I think that's a bit unfair, but that's the argument he makes, right? And so these are more or less the kind of things he was arguing.
Well, but that's why you need, that's why you have control conditions so that you can isolate.
Right, but he even says, even in those control conditions, so he raises that point. So he says, even in those control conditions, there are factors that are introduced that weren't present during the familiarization phase. I don't know if I agree with that, but that's the argument he's making.
Yeah, so, I think I think if people use familiarization without any, without controlling what you call like encoding, right? Because I've seen pretty effectively used VOE study, VOE is violation of expectation, studies that first identify whether an infant has in fact become bored of familiarization stimuli. So they
count, it's trivial, you know, to do, just calculate whether or not the looking time the last three is half the looking time of the first. There you go. You don't need to
have exactly. So you can do that. You can do that, or you can use look away time, like how quickly after the presentation of the stimuli they look away. So that way, at least you have some sort of war. I mean, it's not a guarantee, but there is some sort of encouragement to say that perhaps the encoding has been complete.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I actually think that so the thing is, I don't disagree with a lot of what he's saying in spirit, but I think that there are certain issues with his argument that I take issue with, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, his main claim is we should just do away with this method. I think that's wrong. I think there are things we can, it's sort of like saying throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Like, I think there are things we can do to improve the method without having to dispense with the method. So for example, I might argue that instead of using familiarization, use habituation, right? If you're worried about, if you're trying to disentangle whether or not they're longer looking toward the event that we're calling impossible is due to just that, well, make sure, and not to some lack of encoding, well, make sure they've sufficiently encoded the thing that you were showing them at the very beginning. That's one way, right?
Does he talk about, I mean, so I actually have never done a violation of expectation experiment, yeah, which is funny because I'm an infant researcher.
Yeah.
But isn't that the standard? I mean, isn't the infant controlled stimuli the standard?
That, well, you control for a lot of these low level, as Susan Carey says, these deflationary accounts.
I mean that the infant that you only go on to test once you have some kind of habituation criteria. Okay. No. So that's standard in the Spelke lab. I know that.
Well, that's good. And,
So does he not even talk about that?
No, he doesn't bring that up. Actually, but the funny thing, he brings up habituation, but he says even that's not enough. Like, even bringing up habituation wouldn't improve it. I disagree. And then he actually says, and I agree, or he intimates, and I definitely agree with this point, that one real problem with the violation of expectation method is that when you look across studies in aggregate that use this method, babies will show an inconsistent pattern of looking. So I'll give you a good example from work that I've been doing computationally, right? So Valerie Kohlmeier, Karen Wynn, and Paul Bloom, they were the ones who actually developed that helping and hindering paradigm in 2003, right? Or at least that's when the paper was published, I think in Nature. In any case, one of the methods they use in that study is a violation of expectation method. And so basically, for those who don't know this work, babies are shown a hill, and then this climber wants to reach the top of the hill. It fails, ostensibly, and then on some trials it's helped, and on some trials it's pushed down the hill, right? And then the babies are either are given the actual choice between the helper and the hinderer. So these are actual 3D, three-dimensional puppets or characters. So that's one way to assess whether they have a preference. But a second way, which employs the violation expectation method, is to show them two different events at test and you stagger which one comes first, or you counterbalance which one comes first. In one event, the climber, after it's helped or hindered, either approaches the helper or approaches the hinderer, right? From an adult's perspective, you might expect that if they perceive this event as a social interaction, namely one that involves pro-social action and one that involves antisocial action, you might well be surprised if the climber approaches the hinderer, right, as opposed to the helper. And that's more or less what the baby showed. But there's other studies. So that is, they look longer when the climber approaches, I believe it was the hinderer, right?
Whereas I think that one is the one where it's flipped. Anyways.
Okay.
You might be right. You probably know this.
No. You might be right, actually. But in any case, the whole point is that in some studies, they look longer when the babies approach the helper. And sometimes studies, the babies look longer when the climber approaches the hinderer. What are we to make of these findings? It's not clear to me at all. Like, there's nothing that can be said about that. And I think that's a very real problem with this method, right?
It's all over, too, in developmental psychology. When I first learned about these things, it drove me nuts.
Yeah.
And it still drives me a little nuts. And the thing is, people that have been doing this for a long time aren't surprised by it because, like, it does happen a lot.
Even as someone who critiques this method, that doesn't mean that we dispense with the method. So something else we can do to improve it is to couple that dependent measure with more reliable dependent measures. So it turns out that when you give babies the actual choice, as you know, they more or less, we can argue about whether or not the findings are robust, but when they do show a finding, it tends to be the case that babies reach for the helper, right? So if you pair their looking with that kind of, with something that's more valid, that has more construct validity, right? I think we can start to answer questions about what infants looking in these studies mean, right? So again, I don't think we should do away with the method. I think the method is useful. It can be useful, but I think, I think there's things that we can do to improve the method. He argues that, we shouldn't use the method at all. We should just use like more manual measures. But that misses the point. The reason we use these methods to begin with is because one of the criticisms against Piaget was that a lot of his methods underestimated when babies can do things, right? Just because a baby can't speak doesn't mean that they can't comprehend language. We would never say that, right?
And the other thing is like, you know, without having read this paper, so take this grain of salt, any measure you use with infants, like reaching, looking, like preferential looking, anticipatory looking that I use, violation of expectation, frankly, if you use FNIRs, like all of these things are open for interpretation, right? Like, and even something like reaching, that's interpreted as a preference, but it could be interest. It could be,
I argue that it's not a preference at all.
Yeah,
I mean, that's an expectation for interaction.
Yeah.
Yeah. So far away. Our measures are really far removed from the phenomena. They're very, very proxy. But I think we should start talking about Ashley's work because it's really exciting. And I'm really curious to learn about the measures that you use, Ashley, in your experiments.
Yeah, all right, great. Let's take a break quickly and then we'll come back. Welcome back. This is part two. In this part, we are going to talk with Dr. Thomas about her science paper called Early Concepts of Intimacy, Young Humans Use Saliva Sharing to Infer Close Relationships. And because I don't want to butcher what was done or what the motivation was for the study, I'm going to turn it over actually to Ashley and let her tell us about what the study was about, what she did, what she found, and yeah, we'll sprinkle in there questions.
Yeah, sounds good. So I think the easiest way to introduce this paper is the following. So if you think about two people that you know, one of them you feel super close and intimate with, the other person you might like a lot, but you don't have that close relationship with, who would you rather share a single ice cream cone with by, you know, alternatively licking the ice cream cone?
Neither, because I think that's disgusting.
Well, wait, there's no one.
I'm a germaphobe, though.
There's no one you would share an ice cream cone with? Like, what about your daughter?
Well, what I would do is I would eat the ice cream cone, and the moment I share it with her, I'll just let her keep it. I'll just get another one. You can have that one. I'll get another one.
All right. All right. Well, that's fine. There's some individual differences here. But most people, sorry, Dion, but many people would say the person that they're close to. And anyways, I mean, you said no one, but if you, this was a forced choice.
Yeah, I would say my daughter. Yeah.
Am absolutely. I right?
You're okay. Right. You're absolutely right.
Thank you. All right. So, yeah. So the question is, you know, as adults, we've had years and years of experience that may have led us to this intuition that the way that people share food with each other tells you something about their relationship. And our question was, do even infants know that? So we actually started the paper. I'll just go in order of the studies as we present them in the paper. In the paper, we start with a study that we did with older kids. So this is actually in part a replication of a previous study that Annie Spokes did with Liz Spelke a few years back. And the setup of the study is there's a child who has something, and then we introduce either a family member or a friend, and we ask the participants, the child participants, to predict who this target child will share with. And some of those things are foods that require saliva sharing. So we never say anything about it, but you know, we say he's licking his ice cream. Who do you think he'll give a lick of his ice cream to? Sometimes it's the same spoon. Other times it's candies that you can split up. So those are not saliva sharing items. And then we have these two toy conditions. I can talk a little bit about that, but it's not as interesting as comparing the two food conditions. And what we find is that only the items that require saliva sharing, do kids predict that it will be family who this central target will share with. And the other part of the study was a replication of a previous finding, which was that when it comes to all of these other items, kids don't have a strong prediction that you're more likely to share with family. And you know, there's two ways to, like, the original way in some sense that study was interpreted is that kids just don't know the difference between family and friends. But my perspective on that was like, no, it's just not the right cue, right? Because we share with our friends, we share with all sorts of people. I'll share with a stranger, you know, but the people who I'm willing to share saliva with is a small circle. And we operationalize that through family, but I should make clear here that the type of relationship that we have in mind is not restricted to family members.
Right.
So yeah.
We call it what, thick relationships, or?
We call it thick relationships. Yeah. It was a little bit, so we take that term from the philosopher Marguerite, who wrote about these types of relationships, but it's really connected to Alan Fiske's communal sharing idea. And you know, it's one of those things, but it's also related to like the larger field of anthropology's idea of kin. So anthropologists for a long time have pointed out that the way that people sort of map out their kin structures is not this direct correlation to who you're genetically related to, and it varies across cultures. So it's related to all of those terms, and we chose thick maybe because it was the shortest. Well, no, I guess kin is shorter, but when people think kin, sometimes people think genetic relatedness, which is not what we meant. So that's why I said thick.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm glad that it was philosophy and not Urban Dictionary then.
Although I don't know, I wouldn't disparage the Urban Dictionary. There's some real insights there. Have you seen the word for gleek? Gleek means to like,
I know what gleek means.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And it like made its way into the regular dictionary. So like,
oh, really?
Yeah. No, that's not an Urban Dictionary.
Yeah.
So ask me how I know that.
It's only when I was practicing giving job talks that someone's like, can you not use thick? Because all I could think of was like T-H-I-C-C when you were talking about it. And I was like,
the fact that their mind went there, it's like, you're the only person in this room probably whose mind goes there.
I mean, someone also was like, oh, I get it. It's like through thick and thin. And I was like, nope, didn't mean that. But yeah, that's true.
I think,
you know, back to this like conversation that we're having about like how I think about things.
Yeah.
The other reason why I say thick is because I really do think about these things as like nodes and lines. Yep. And question is, how thick is that connection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. The node. Yeah. That's a good metaphor. Yeah. Actually, I think it probably clarifies for the listeners. Yeah.
That's definitely the graphic I use in talks and stuff. So I can talk a little bit about the work that we did with infants and toddlers. That comes next. So
Before you go into that, Ashley, do you mind telling us just a little bit more why specifically that direction? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if I am especially someone who's just interested in developmental psychology and not one of researchers, I wonder, were you inspired by the relevance to public health, especially in the current, you know, pandemic environment? Or how did you come up with this idea, especially with background in more like social psychology and not so much animal behavior, right? Like I understand it correctly. How did you come up with this idea?
I'll just tell you how so this work was all conceived of before the pandemic. So I should just say that. Although of course, when the pandemic hit, like everybody else, I was like, you know, trying to find connections and stuff like that, which I didn't end up actually really following through with. But the history of this study is this. So I was doing some preliminary work for actually another paper. And what I wanted to do is replicate a preference for imitators, the non-preference for the imitated, but then I was also looking at comforting. So, you know, comforting and imitation has the same quality in that you can be the target or the actor in that interaction. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, surely, like infants like helpers, they like imitators, they will like people who comfort. That is like a thing that if anything they have experience with, it's a lot, they have a lot of experience with being comforted. But what we found, and actually what other people in the Spelke lab have found as well, is that we can't find any evidence that they prefer comforters over non-comforters. So of course there's a lot of reasons why infant experiments can fail. Maybe they don't understand. Maybe the way that we showed them comforting wasn't meaningful to them. You know, this is with a puppet and a person. Maybe their ideas about comforting are only with people or something like that. But the most interesting idea was that when you see two people comforting each other, it's not the same as when you see somebody helping someone else, in that you would never expect, well, maybe not never, but if you have no relation to the people that you're observing in a comforting interaction, you would not assume that that applies to you, because comforting happens within specific types of relationships. It's a sort of emotional intimacy that at least in my experience is reserved to a smaller subset of my cooperative relationships. Whereas I'll help all sorts of people. I'll help a stranger on the street. We help people that we barely know. We help people that we are colleagues. Like there's just a huge range of people that we'll do instrumental helping with. And at least my intuition, this is an empirical question, there's a much smaller subset of people who I want to be comforted by and who I'll comfort. So that really got us going on this idea that actually this distinction between those types of interactions and between these types of relationships might be really meaningful. The more we thought about it, the more we were like, yeah, that could be really meaningful for infants because, you know, they depend on care, like caregiving is sort of a prototypical thick relationship. As I mentioned, Alan Fisk is, you know, like an intellectual hero of mine. He's also a mentor of mine. He's long pointed out that one way his communal sharing relationships are formed and maintained is through sharing bodily fluids. So that's where the connection between sharing saliva and these types of relationships really come from is from anthropological work and ethnographic work. you know, and intuitions. Like the thing about it is like that example that I gave is really intuitive. So it's kind of a combination of those two things. And yeah, actually, you know, I'll describe what we did with infants and toddlers right now. But actually our measure there is directly taken from non-human primate research. So, and I'll talk about a little bit about that. So what we did to test this with infants and toddlers, our infants were 8 to 10 month olds and our toddlers were 16 to 18 month olds. I think Dion might be able to, maybe not, maybe you're more better about this. Those age ranges were kind of just intuitive.
Yeah. I mean, there's some reason to choose those too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'll talk a little bit about some recent findings I have too, but what we did is we showed them two interactions. So it's two different women with one puppet. And in one of them, she takes a bite of an orange, puts the orange in the puppet's mouth, and then takes another bite. So that's the saliva sharing one. And then in the other one, they pass the ball back and forth. So we deliberately chose these two pro-social interactions, two common experiences that these infants and toddlers likely have, with the idea being that one of those is supposed to be an interaction that would happen within a thick relationship. And then to test that idea, we showed the puppet crying. And the question is, who do they look at first? How long do they look at these two women during a brief pause as an anticipatory measure? Basically, where on the screen do they expect action to happen? And you know, back to our previous conversation, like, we made it a point to say response to distress because we don't actually know what they're expecting. Like, we don't know what response they're expecting.
But nonetheless, one prediction you might otherwise make, at least an adult-centered prediction, is that if saliva sharing is a cue to thick relationships, that is, it's an indicator that these two people are more than just friends, yeah, right? And if babies understand that, that in turn is related to, you know, how one should respond to a person who's expressing distress, you might otherwise expect them to look at, as a first measure, the longest at the one who they shared saliva with via sharing the orange slice or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the logic of the study. And actually, we took that from non-human primate work. I mean, I'm not the first developmental psychologist to use anticipatory looking, but Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfarth did this amazing work where they would go out and they would go to where groups of, they have versions in baboons and monkeys. Well, actually baboons are monkeys, but rhesus monkeys, I think. And I didn't know baboons were monkeys until like 6 months ago. But anyway, they would record the distress calls of monkeys and then they would put speakers out into the wild where these groups of monkeys hang out. They would wait until one of those monkeys weren't around and then they would play that distress call and measure who the monkeys looked at. And the monkeys would look at the kin of that individual that was in distress. So this is super cool because it suggests that these monkeys are tracking relationships. Mm-hmm. And in our study, of course, we're not asking what infants know about the relationships in their own social networks. We're asking, given these two interactions, you know, what relationships are you inferring here?
No, but I think there's a relationship, right? So like in the wild, the assumption is that they will have learned before hearing the distress what constitutes which relationships are thick. And so you have to have some way of inducing a sensitivity to thickness, right, to begin with. So I think the way you did this is the way it should be done.
No. So the other thing I'm working on is more of a question of how infants learn about their own specific social connections by using the infant's caregiver in the stimuli. Yeah, I mean, the one sort of, I think an interesting way that, so in non-human primate literature, there's a lot of work about how infants, or not infants, how adult individuals understand relationships within their social worlds, but not as much about how they actually learn about those relationships. So there's a lot of different mechanisms that could lead to them understanding how people are related to each other. It could just be that those two people are together a lot. It could be that it's the way they groom. It could be that they share food. You know, there's a ton of different options. And as far as I know, and I'm certainly not a non-human primate expert, as far as I know, that's under I'm not saying no one studied it, but I'm just saying that as far as I know, we don't know. whereas, you know, the opposite is true with human infants. We know a lot more about how they reason about strangers and less about how they reason about people they actually know. So anyways, that's a focus of a different paper of mine. But yeah, so the next thing we wanted to know is, you know, there's two ways you can interpret this initial finding. Did I say what the finding is? They look longer and first at the food share.
Yeah. As we have. I was gonna say, yeah, no, you didn't do it, but that you just did it. Yeah.
Okay, so there's two ways you could interpret that finding. Well, there's probably lots of ways, but there's at least two ways you can interpret it. One is, you know, in line with a bunch of other research, infants pay attention to who's pro-social, and sharing food is just a nicer thing to do than passing a ball back and forth. They're both nice, but, you know, being willing to put your food in somebody else's mouth means that you're a nice person. And so, you know, that's kind of the logic, the argument in the help or hinderer studies is that if you see someone help someone else, the reason why babies reach for that helper is that they assume that that person will be nice to them too. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's different ways to interpret that.
Oh, definitely.
But that's the argument underlying a lot of that work. So the same argument could be applied here. The reason why they look first and longer at the food share is not because they're inferring any relationship. They just think that individual is nice. Or it could be about a relationship. So the way that we tested that question is we replicated our original finding. So kids were randomly assigned to either the original paradigm or this new control paradigm, where it's not the blue puppet who had these interactions that's upset, it's a new individual. With the idea being that if this is about a trait, they should again look first and longer at the food share, because mm-hmm. that person should respond to anybody. They should just be more responsive. But if they're encoding a relationship between those two people, mm-hmm. we didn't give them any information about who this kangaroo has a relationship to. Mm-hmm. And so they should be a chance. And what we find is that they're a chance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and this was true for both infants and toddlers. Then the last control study we only did with toddlers because it required some language. And what we did there is we again replicated our original finding, but this time it was the blue puppet again. But the question here was, do they have specific expectations about the types of actions that people do in a thick relationship? Or is it that thick partners will be more responsive in general? So in this last control experiment, the blue puppet asked for a ball. And the logic there is if they think thick partners will be just more responsive, they should look again first and longer at the thick partner.
Sorry, yeah, we're for those who are listening, there's a buzz in my ear, and I'm trying to figure out whose mic is coming from. I think it might be mine. Hopefully you all don't hear it. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I don't hear the buzzing. I just
Oh, okay, good. Did it probably in my head.
Yeah. Okay. So this last experiment's question is, do they have specific expectations about how people in a thick relationship will act, or do they just expect them to be more responsive in general? So this last one, we have the puppet request a ball, with the hypothesis being that if they expect thick partners to respond to anything, they should look first and longer at that thick partner. But if it's a specific expectation, then here they should look at the ball, the person who had passed a ball at the puppet, because that's the person who would most likely have the ball and pass it to the puppet. And the other thing just to mention about this last study is that like many developmental psychology studies, our original samples were super biased in terms of 25% of our kids, our babies had parents who had PhDs, which is 25 times that rate in the US. So we made a concerted effort to get a more representative sample of the US. We weren't 100% successful, but we definitely improved it being representative in terms of region, race, the education level of their parents, as well as income. But you know, it's still pretty skewed. It's still skewed white and high SES, but
yeah,
it's a little. But that's the first toddler study.
Yeah.
Yeah. But should I do the second one, or do you want to ask questions about that one first?
Sure.
Let's maybe ask questions because there are, I think, a couple of things that kind of popped up, and I think maybe the listeners would be curious too. So first, I just wanted to clarify. So the point of the study was the following: you operationalized relationship, the thickness of relationship as saliva sharing. And then a question was, whom do babies expect caregiving from, right? And you say, so that one way to signal thickness of relationship is saliva. And so they expect caregiving from thick relationship parties. Is that in a nutshell?
Yeah. Well, responses to distress. So yeah, like if you can kind of picture this, what my argument is, what the hypothesis of the underlying process is that they see who shares saliva, then they use that to infer who has a thick relationship. And from inferring who has a thick relationship, they then use that to predict who will respond to each other's distress.
Right. And so I think this is quite fascinating, Adam. What I'm curious is, if you were to place this finding in a grander scheme of knowledge that we have about infant social development and, you know, caregiver-infant relations, where does it stand? So how do we fit that with the rest of our knowledge?
I think the reason, like the thing that this series of studies is adding to the literature is maybe one way to answer the question. And as I mentioned, there's been a lot of work about like, how do infants think about traits? And then there's been other work that's like, how do infants think about these like sort of macro groups, like in groups and out groups? Well, there's been a little bit less work about infants, but definitely a lot of work about kids. And where my work in general is situated is kind of in between those two things. So on the one hand, like it's sort of like naive. It's not quite naive psychology, because I think you can't explain this from some account that's like utility based, for example, because well, in this study, it might be more valuable to share food. But when I talk about the next set of studies, it's pretty hard to give me an account that's about utility, that would lead to the series of findings. And sort of how this intersects with groups, I'm not as certain about, because even though from some other work, we might expect that at least toddlers would have expectations about, say, who passes the ball back and forth with each other based on groups, you know, we didn't directly test that. So it could be that they think that the thing that they're representing is actually whether or not these two people are in the same group, not like whether they're connected. But my argument is that infants are paying attention to not only who's connected, but how they're connected based on the way that people interact with each other.
Mm-hmm. And do you, well, to ask that sort of our big dangerous question, you know, given the inspiration from you mentioned animal behavior work.
Yeah.
Do you think that your finding signals something about potentially innately specified assumption about saliva sharing, maybe broadly construed as hygienic distance or something like that?
Yeah.
I say quickly that I love how we all jump around the word innate. Like, we just sort of, like, do we use the word? Do we say
it's okay? I'm not scared.
Euphemism.
I'm not scared to talk about. I mean, to me, what innate means is that evolution has given it to us.
Someone has read Susan Carey.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also epigenetic development. So those are somewhat separate.
Sure, that's true. But even like epigenetics is not like, it just shapes things, right? It's not like blasting things out of the water, at least my understanding of it. For lack of a better way to explain that or describe that. But yeah, I mean, the question is, what's innate? And in some sense, like, you know, when I was talking to some of my co-authors about this, the argument is like, well, why are you studying infants if you don't want to make claims about what's innate? And that's actually not really why I study infants. So it's not that I'm not interested in this question. So first, let's lay out what could be innate, right? So there's different possibilities. One is that none of this is innate and that it's all the result of associative learning. And as I said, like infants have a lot of experience with parents. And yeah. that's what I think is sort of a prototypical thick relationship. Jesse Snydecker just was arguing to me that the thing that we're actually studying is not this broad category of thick relationships, but actually is a caregiver, a parent-child relationship. And that mm-hmm. that's the thing that we're picking up on. And there's actually a little bit of data in that in our second experiment, mm-hmm. because infants have a harder time with the inference that a puppet will respond to a human adult's distress than toddlers do. So there's a little bit of evidence there. There could be an innate representation that's just mommy, who's mommy and who's baby. And it's kind of mm-hmm. cool then if that's true, that even in as a third party, they pick up on these cues. And then, the other spectrum is that the whole package is innate, that not only is, whatever relationship we're studying, that representation is innate, but also the fact that saliva sharing goes with that is innate. I don't think this data really speak to it. I think we would need a lot more convergent evidence to make any claims about what's innate here. But if you want to know what my intuition is, if you want to hold my feet to the fire, I think what I favor is that there's some ability to represent relationships that's innate and that we're able to rapidly map on the cues that go with that relationship.
Specifically the genetic relatedness relationship, is that?
No. I do not mean genetic relatedness, because I certainly wouldn't assume that a infant who's adopted into a family, for example, isn't assuming right. that the input that mm-hmm. they're getting is any different. Like I definitely don't think it's genetic relatedness. The question of, I don't know, I go back and forth about whether I sort of think saliva sharing is especially easy to learn, for example. And one reason to think that it might be especially easy to learn is that you just find a lot of cross-cultural convergence, that it's meaningful to people. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of differences in terms of how liberal or constricted saliva sharing is, both individually, as Dion was kind of pointing out, and if you look at culture sort of at the macro scale. So one thing I'm actually really interested in doing is looking at culture on the micro scale. So when I was a kid, I remember being super shocked by how different like families do stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. And something about saliva sharing and who, like how liberal or constricted people are with that, I would guess is pretty individually variable and might vary by household to a pretty big extent. So that could be a cool thing to look at. I would love to address cultural infant research, but it's tough. Go ahead.
Can I push back? I'm sure the folks who are listening are like, when the hell is he going to pipe in and like push back? I don't know if this is a pushback so much as a question.
Yeah.
But in reading the paper, it struck me as odd that they would even need to use saliva as a cue to infer thick relationships. Why couldn't they just learn about what constitutes a thick relationship just based on the fact that people who are in those relationships not only are around each other more often, but also engage in sharing that involved the mouth in some way? And the reason I make that specific point is because in this paper, the sharing was all like the effect was sort of, so you're attributing the effect to saliva sharing, but obviously there's a free rider, so to speak. That is, those events also take place near the mouth, and that tends to happen in families. And so, and also it seems odd to me to attribute this to saliva sharing, given that I would argue, again, with no data, this is an empirical question, but I might argue that saliva sharing is only intermittently available. Right. So mm-hmm. it wouldn't be a reliable cue at all anyway, because it's only fleeting in the environment. So do we have data? I guess one question is, couldn't you learn this just by virtue of how frequently people in thick relationships interact? But also, do we have data on whether or not saliva sharing is above a threshold where it would be detectable and could be used as a reliable cue? That is, does it have cue validity for pick relationships. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are great questions. So just, I want to clarify, and I don't know if this paragraph made it in the final draft because of the extreme word. We basically need to write a longer paper to really lay out what we think about all these things. But at some point in this paper, we had a whole paragraph of like, we don't know if this is saliva. Like, as I mentioned before, the puppets don't have saliva. We tried to be careful to say like implied saliva sharing, but you are totally right that this could be just about mouths.
Say that again.
You are totally right that this could just be about mouths.
Say that again.
You could be totally right. Yeah. I am not wedded to the fact that this is saliva. And I think you're also right that like the idea that infants have a representation of saliva seems pretty like exactly the same. Like it can't be the same representation that adults have. Yeah. That seems like definitely it has to be wrong. Yeah. But to answer your other question, I do think you're wrong about that. So I don't think, so my child, so she's 2 years, 9 months, mm-hmm. but from the time that she was about 2.5 months, when I started having childcare, it was not true that the people that she spent the most time with were the thickest people in her life. And whether that's a weird thing in our society is an open question. Again, there's a lot of open questions here about how this would show up in different cultures, both depending on the saliva sharing norms, but also in terms of who takes care of babies. Now, one
so you thing can't, in other words, you can't necessarily, you would argue that frequency is probably not tied to, it's not like a critical ingredient for thick relationships because babies can be around people all the time, but not actually be in a thick relationship. I mean, that's what going to daycare is all about, right? You're not in thick relationships with these individuals, right?
Yeah, we wouldn't expect daycare teachers to have like long and enduring attachments with babies. Yeah. It would be cruel if we, like, if I expected that, then I think I would feel a lot more uncomfortable dropping my kid off, right?
Weird. So, weird.
Yeah. And like, I could be wrong. I know enough people who have worked in childcare to know that like, they're fond of the kids that they take care of, but they don't form not the type of attachment that I have with my kid. Right. So yeah. And then the last thing is like, we have some empirical evidence that we're right about this. So the last study in our paper, we actually asked parents of infants between the ages that we tested. And we said, you know, list everyone that your kid has had contact with. It was weird because it was during the pandemic. Then we asked them about a bunch of different interactions that would be commonly done with kids. And we asked them about the frequency and how frequent they think these things are and how comfortable they would be. Mm-hmm. I will say that kind of to your point, the frequency of, what we were looking for is a correlation between how thick they rated these relationships to be without saying anything about saliva sharing. We just gave a definition that was like long and enduring attachment, sad when you're dead, that kind of thing. And then how frequent these different types of interactions would happen. The frequency is actually not super strong. We suspect that could be pandemic related. So I'd like to review that study if anything ever gets back to normal. But we find a really strong effect for comfort. That parents are way more comfortable with their kids sharing saliva with people who they also consider to have a thick relationship. We did that study for exactly your concern, which is this actually a cue that infants could use?
I wonder, in thinking about like really getting at the saliva sharing, because I was saying that one of my concerns is that, you know, is to what extent can we conclude that this is about saliva sharing? As opposed to events that happen near one's mouth, and that tends to happen more often in thick relationships. And I think one easy way to test that is like to have actual food sharing and just events that happen, like passing of balls or something, whatever, around the mouth, right? And if in fact you show what you're showing, that is babies look longer at the caregiver, the person with whom they shared saliva after expressing distress, then this would really start to triangulate on that this is something about possibly saliva, right?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing though.
Yeah.
So my most recent favorite idea that I've had,
yeah,
say maybe, is something like this, and I haven't quite.
Well, all your ideas are your favorite ideas, apparently, but this is your most recent one. I would hope all your ideas are your favorite ideas.
No, sometimes I have ideas that aren't my favorite.
Yeah, okay.
You know, when you think of things and you're like, ah, crap, this person I've been arguing with is right. Yeah. Those aren't my favorite ideas. No, but so Tomer Ullman, I was reading his this actually recently, and he makes this, he's making this argument about sort of naive physics and naive psychology.
Yeah.
And something he says is that it could be true. Like, so one, if you buy that infants have ideas of agents, and that part of that is that they basically don't act like objects. I mean, that's not how people usually say it, but they say things like self-generated motion and acts with goals and desires or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But he kind of makes this argument like, well, in order to make those inferences, you have to have some physics, right? Because you have to know that that thing's not acting like an object.
Yep.
And I think that's a pretty compelling argument.
Yep.
The thing that I was thinking about is, you know, all the work that's been done, at least, you know, at MIT and other places about agency recently is about this naive utility calculus stuff, which is like, you can do this reverse inference. If you assume that people are rational actors, you can make all these inferences about their goals and desires based on how they move, where they move. But one thing that I found really compelling about that is to take this to naive sociology, which is my world, is when you can no longer rationalize someone's action, and there's probably some other criteria that need to be met, like there's two people in a scene or something, then you're forced to say this is about social communication. And so that's why I wonder if some of these counterexamples, so this is why I'm totally fine with this not being about saliva sharing, because I think that like the point here is that like there's lots of different ways you can eat food, right?
Yep.
They're eating food like this. And this, there's no way to explain the way they're eating food. Or I didn't talk about the second experiment we did, but in the second experiment, the saliva sharing, she puts her finger in her mouth, puts her finger in the puppet's mouth, puts her finger back in her mouth. Why the hell would you be doing, sorry, excuse my French. Why the heck would you be doing that?
We curse on here all the time.
Okay, cool. Yeah. unless you're trying to communicate something socially, right? There's no way to explain that based on utility. And the other thing about that action is like, it's also just not a super common, that whole interaction is not a super common interaction. So I think maybe the place where you and I might differ, and I'll ask you, is not even necessarily the learning story, because I'm not committed to one learning story or another.
Yeah.
Maybe the one thing I'm not committed to is that it's totally like we start with nothing.
I'm not even committed to that idea. We don't start with nothing.
Yeah. So, you know, we might be more or less committed to how abstract the starting point is.
Yeah.
But the thing that I'm really committed to based on this data is that there has to be some kind of way to generalize to this weird thing that we showed them, right? Like whatever representation they have has to be abstract enough that they're able to see this finger in mouth, finger in the puppet's mouth, finger back in my mouth, and still make that inference.
Yeah, I mean, that tends to happen like with Alina now, my daughter.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon for her actually. She has this weird thing where she likes me to put my finger in her mouth, or she puts her finger in my mouth.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's as infrequent as one might think. And so, you know, maybe, you know, there's a sense in which you could view that event as irrational and therefore can't be explained by proponents of naive calculus, but that doesn't mean that the event doesn't happen. And it could be on this basis that when the infant is exposed to that kind of event, it's plausible. Like, I do this kind of thing with mommy all the time, or daddy, or caregiver, or what have you.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I, to be honest with you, like I'm in some sense, it's kind of more fun if that's the explanation, because there's a lot more work to be done.
I would have liked to see you do not the saliva head-to-head sharing thing, but like the same thing, but you just go like this. There's no putting it in the mouth. Just kind of like what I was saying, to really get at
whether this is, it would be interesting. Or maybe sharing. Like, well, so here's a question.
Yeah.
This is a weird idea I just had in you, you know, touching your mouth. I think kind of touching your mouth and touching someone else's mouth, my intuition is that would be the same. Because like kissing someone on the lips.
No, I mean even just hovering around the mouth. Like you make it clear that they're hovering. Because I think that it's sort of, I guess the question that I am interested in knowing the answer to is whether or not this is truly about saliva sharing, because that is the story you are making. right? Yeah. And I think I would be more convinced that this has something to do with saliva, even if we disagree about the story about how this comes about. If you show that even in a super, super closely control condition where you do more or less the same thing, except there's no actual touching, but everything happens around the mouth, and you still show that this differential effect, I would be more convinced that this has to be due to something about saliva sharing. Yeah. And then we can ask about what the mechanism is as a separate question.
Yeah, that would be cool. And like, you know, I in some sense, I feel bad saying like, well, I'm not actually that committed to it being saliva sharing, because like, I don't want to be the, what's it called? There's a term for this, which is where you—
dogmatic.
No. The opposite, which is where you make a claim, but then you actually say, I'm not making, you make a lesser claim. So it's easier to defend.
Straw manning?
No, it's not straw manning. It's like, it's a term from like warfare. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, now it's going to bug me because I'm, I like
to. I'll let you know. But yeah, like the point is that it's a little bit annoying when people do that. Like the point, we did make the claim that it's saliva sharing in this paper, and we made it for reasons that are connected to, you know, anthropology, ethnography, our own intuitions. But yeah, I think that's a cool idea. The other thing that people have asked me about is whether it would make sense to do only half the interaction. But the thing is I think that would work because like, I think if I stick my, like, I don't want to put my finger in most people's mouths.
Right.
Like that's disgusting.
Right.
So even if it's not,
I agree. Yeah, I don't know.
It maybe wouldn't have been as snappy of a paper if we said something about mouths.
Right.
But I mean, there's actually other cool fun. Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, since doing this work, I didn't know this before we started doing this, like the chaining Seyfarth stuff, but people that study macaques have told me that in some macaque groups, so it's a culturally specific thing, they do these like trust exercises where they stick each other's fingers like in their nostrils and in their mouths and like in their eyeballs. Like somebody sent me a video of it and they're like, they're totally like zenned out, like relaxing, like doing this weird
thing. Oh, that is so funny.
But yeah, it's kind of interesting because it's like, the first person who told me said, oh, people interpret that as I trust you enough to not bite my finger off. And I guess like chimps do this thing, male chimps like will hold each other's testicles. And that's also like, you're literally putting your reproductive future in each other's hands. But the video I saw was like also in their nose and like, that's not really dangerous. So anyways, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So this is maybe a minor question, but, and it's not even about this innate issue or anything like that.
Sure.
But something that was really interesting that puzzled me is in one, I think it was in experiment one, you show that although the toddlers or the kids, I guess, are more likely to say that they're more likely to say that this character is going to share with their sister, you know, someone
saliva sharing.
Yeah, to do saliva sharing with a sister. That wasn't true for divisible items. The reason this finding is weird, like, so let me be clear for those who are listening. So it turns out that when you ask them whether or not, you know, this person is going to share not an item via saliva sharing, but via some other method, just sharing toys, they're sort of at chance. That is, sometimes they say that they'll share with the sister and sometimes they say with the other person. That's weird to me, right? Because I think evolutionarily you might predict that they should like overwhelmingly share with their sister. Why wouldn't you share with your sister, regardless of whether or not it's a something that has to do with saliva or not? Like, it's just weird that they would be at chance to begin with.
Yeah. Well, so here's, so I think that there is, you know, this is actually maybe my favorite finding in the paper for this reason. Because I think you're right. What people think about a lot when they think of like evolutionary psychology is like altruism, kin-based altruism. You know, there's an equation people use. The welfare trade-off folks also make a similar argument. I think that, you know, the more genetics you share with someone, the more you should value their utility or whatever.
Well, my argument really was, it wasn't evolutionary, but the argument was based on group fitness. So the idea is that if I'm helping out, irrespective of whether or not the person is my, you know, genetically related to me, if I'm engaging in pro-social actions, when
you know, I find myself in a precarious situation. Because I will have helped that person in the past, that person will in turn help me. And this in turn has a direct effect on my fitness, right? Mm-hmm. And so sharing, it was weird to me that, you know, across the board, they wouldn't share with someone who they presumably would have engaged in pro-social action with in the past, given that they are genetic relatives.
Yeah. Right?
And so again, the fact that it was only in that one condition was weird to me.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, there's other... So it's interesting that you're talking, I mean, I don't really know, like, it's funny because I don't really know, like, all the arguments about group selection. I know that that's pretty controversial, but even if you take group selection to be an important thing, then it shouldn't predict, in some sense, it should predict that you should want to share more with friends, right? Because those are the relationships that are on shakier ground. They're still in your group, but if you share with them, that means that they will do something back for you, right? Whereas the whole thing about thick relationships and communal,
right? Because you can almost be sure, because by virtue of being genetic relatives, oh, I got that one for free. So now I have to win this person over, is the argument.
Yeah. Or even if you're not genetic relatives, you have such an established relationship. And like, I don't know how old, I think your kid might be too young for this, but
13 months.
Okay. I think she might be a little too young for this, but like my toddler is an absolute terror around my husband and I. Like she is like just so mean to us. Like,
that's funny. Oh, she's not quite
She tells my husband to get out of room. She hits me with the just like all the things. She pours like things on the ground in front of us. And then as we're cleaning that up, she goes and pours another thing and then laughs. Yeah. Absolute terror. I mean, she's hilarious and I love her, but just so badly behaved around us. And then around like other people, she's a perfect angel. and she knows, like, to some, I think I've talked a lot.
She has you in her bag.
Yeah. Like, I'm not going anywhere. She knows that.
Right.
I mean, I'm glad she knows that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think.
No, you're right. But you didn't even show that though. It wasn't like they, you know, so what you're arguing is right, but you didn't even show that.
Yeah. So they're just a chance with sharing. And it is kind of interesting. I think on my account, as you're right, on my account, they should think that people should share more with friends than siblings. But I don't know. I just think that, they just don't differentiate. That's when it comes to sharing. Yeah. I think that kids just don't have a strong intuition in general, but it's just like these saliva sharing things. And, you know, a lot of that could just be taught too. Like, it's hammered into kids' heads, you should share with your siblings and your friends.
Yeah.
And also it's, I'm not arguing that teaching's not involved in that intuition either, because clearly they're taught that you should be careful about germs and stuff too. So,
So I'll ask maybe one more question. I don't want to keep you too long,
sure.
But sort of something that occurred to me, which I guess in some sense could be paradoxical, has to do with separation anxiety. So for those who don't know, who are listening, there's a certain point in development where kids are just terrified of other people, of people they, you know, have never seen.
In the U.S.
And
That's not true in many other cultures.
Okay, so it's a U.S. specific finding? Well, that's true. Okay, so in the U.S., that's true. And so the reason I bring that up is because, well, wouldn't you predict then that if a child is exposed to a person, let's say they see two people, two, you know, mommy sharing food with someone who they're close with, who they would have shared saliva with before in the past, sharing saliva with a completely new stranger. If you can first establish that they do show stranger anxiety and then show that, oh, once mommy shares food with this stranger, having said absolutely nothing, so there has to be no other cues to cues that would indicate that, oh, mommy knows this person or my caregiver knows this person. Wouldn't you predict that that should mitigate stranger anxiety if, in fact, saliva sharing is supposed to be linked to or have some relation with, thick relationships? That seems like a sort of paradox. That seems like a really cool prediction that you can test that really, I think, provides some pretty strong evidence for this idea that you're trying to push.
Yeah. So this is like on the docket.
Because, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I have, nice. I mean, I haven't started it yet. Well, actually, I have a really funny stimuli that
yeah, yeah.
I may not use. But so I have another paper that's not, so I started this other work before this whole idea of thick and thin relationships came up. But so in that paper, what we do, it's a yoked control design. So every infant sees their own parent and two puppets and another infant's parent and two puppets. And the parent imitates one puppet and not the other. And the question there is, do infants infer a social connection with this puppet, given the fact that mom imitates, I saw mom imitate them specifically.
And what's the measure of social interaction? Or
Yeah. So first we did reaching and we find a reaching preference only in the parent condition. But as we talked about earlier, reaching is super ambiguous, but also the pandemic hit. So we
have actually reaching is robust. That's one of the, I guess we could disagree. Maybe
it could be robust, but it's still ambiguous.
Yeah. What does it mean? Right. Right.
Yeah.
But it triangulates with preferential looking too. And they, so.
Sometimes, but what's interesting is we don't find preferential looking. So, what Liz before we started this predicted that because exactly what you're talking about, this stranger danger age at around 12 months.
Yeah.
She thinks that the reason why you no longer find a lot of looking preferences at that age is because they start to be very interested in the wrong character because they're leery of them.
Uh-huh.
So you get these long suspicious stares, as this is Liz's words. So anyways, we actually did have a looking preference and we didn't find it in the lab. And then when we were forced to go on Zoom, I knew we didn't have this looking preference. So I couldn't just do a straight looking preference because I knew I wouldn't find it.
Yeah.
So what we did is we have this measure where both mouths move simultaneously. And one voice, if you're the baby, says, Hi, Dion. And the question is, who do they think is the source of that voice? Do they think it's the puppet that their mom imitated, or do they think it's the other puppet? And what we find is only in this speaking thing, do they look at the source only in the speaking test.
Yep.
After they see their own parent, a stranger, do they look at this puppet?
Yep.
And then we also have another experiment I just finished that's pretty exciting, where either the puppets are facing forward and using your name, or they look pretty similar. They're still animated, still using infant-directed speech, but they're facing away using somebody else's name.
Uh-huh.
I forget, the listeners can't see me. I'm moving my...
Yeah, she's her hands are puppeting toward the camera.
Yeah.
Versus away from the camera.
Right? Yeah. And so what we find there is that only when the puppets are facing forward using the infant's own name, do they look at the puppet who's imitated by their parent. But to your question, before I started this study, a lot of parents were like, this is not going to work because they're going to be super jealous of this imitated puppet.
Yeah.
And the argument that we're really trying to make in that paper is that we don't know how they feel about this puppet. Right? Like, we don't have a good measure of them liking this puppet, being motivated to affiliate with this puppet, except maybe the reaching, but that could just be interest. What we're really arguing is that they infer that this puppet is more likely to know them, basically know their name. And this could totally be associative learning, by the way. Like, it could just be that by the time they're a year old, they've had so much experience being with their mom and meeting different people. And like, I'm happy with that account because that would still mean that they get to learn about their social networks, right?
Yeah.
Which is the thing that I'm after. So
But I think I would want to take it a step further and ask, do they actually like shirk when they're, you know, in the typical stranger anxiety paradigm?
Yeah.
Do they like hesitate for the character that didn't share saliva? I don't know.
Yeah. So here's what I want to do. Yeah. This is actually, I got this from Mazarin at Harvard, some of this idea. So I've actually been kind of struggling. So I've been wanting to do like a thick versus thin with mom. And so mom does a thick thing with one partner, and a thin but friendly thing with the other partner. And the question is, well, what's a good dependent measure there? And your prediction is great because you're saying like, you know, if we do this with people, then all this stranger danger stuff might get relaxed, which would be really cool. But one thing we could do is kind of fake sharing saliva. So the question is, because the other thing that comes up a lot with this work is that the disbelief that this could be true because infants will put anything in their mouths. Like the whole disgust sensitivity doesn't come online for like pretty late in kids. And that's true.
Yep.
But I think it's an empirical question. who infants really are comfortable doing this with. Yeah. And I could be wrong. I'm happy to be wrong about this, but we could do a sort of sneaky experiment where, like, actually with puppets, we wouldn't even have to be sneaky. Basically the thick partner, the puppet could put like a candy in their mouth. The thin partner could put a candy in their mouth. And the question is, which candy do you want to put in your mouth now, baby? And like, you know, we could manipulate whether there's saliva sharing there, like if it's just who you take food from, which we also might find an effect. But it would be cool if it was, you know, I'll take food from anyone. Because both of these people, clearly my mom's okay with, but I'm only going to restrict my thick interaction with this thick puppet.
Yeah, that would be cool. I mean, there's clearly some questions still to answer, but at least what you've done is interesting. Oh, yeah. And honestly, I could talk about this all day.
Was so fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks for coming on. For those who are wondering what the hell happened to Elena, she had to leave. So you are left with me. I'm sorry.
We talked too long. Well, partly because Dion, I was like so curious about your take on that Marcus Paulus paper.
You got to read it if you haven't read it. Like, it's interesting.
I will. Yeah. It's on my list. But yeah, I mean, just to kind of come back to this idea about there's so many questions. I think that like that's where I'm at with this work is that I think it's going to take years before I'm really confident in saying what we've found.
I mean, that's
and true that's great because then I have a lot of work to do.
Exactly. That's true for my work as well. Like, you know, I just recently published this thing where I offer this alternative account for what's happening in the Hamlin studies. But like, there's a lot of work yet to be done before I can be confident that what I'm arguing is, in fact, I need behavioral data, right? Yeah. And so just like you, at least I have stuff to do, right? You know, I have no excuse, right? Can't ever say I'm bored. But anyway, it's been great. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Yeah, I'll tune in to the next episode. And yeah.